My name is Caroline Hornstein-Tomic. I'm a sociologist and cultural anthropologist by training, and I do work in academia and research, but my heart beats for civic education. And NECI, the European Network of Civic Education, is something that we are today celebrating for the next 2 days in a festival here in Madrid, where we discuss the challenges that we are facing today, but especially also in the future. So listen into our conversation. Thank you.
Welcome to the Visegrad Insight podcast from Central Europe on Central Europe.
And it's a go.
Okay. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Visegrad Insights podcast. My name is Galen Dahl, and I'm here with Adam Yesser.
Hello.
All right. We're here to discuss all that is important in Central Europe. Of course, there's a lot of news that's been popping around with different larger events, such as the EU and Chinese summit, which is occurring in a couple days, as well as the forthcoming Ukrainian summit, which will be next week. But today, we want to focus on the ongoing events in Poland. And Adam wrote an excellent article last week, kind of breaking down it as an explainer for us. So Adam, I want to start things off. What are you expecting to see happen on the 11th of December?
Well, it seems now that that the opposition parties that formed a coalition after elections on October 15th will finally be able to form a cabinet and be elected by parliament. The outgoing government has delayed the transition of power since then, and at the moment we still have Prime Minister Mateusz Morawiecki of the Law and Justice Party sort of pretending that he's governing despite not having a majority in parliament. He appointed a cabinet of people who are not really frontline politicians, and he insists that he hopes to win a vote of confidence in parliament next week or by December 11. And of course, everyone realizes that this is wishful thinking, given that he lacks a few dozen votes in the lower house of parliament. It's really hard to explain why the ruling party just refuses to acknowledge its defeat in the election and sort of hand over power in a civilized way. Unfortunately, it's a wider trend we see in many countries that are sort of weakening democratic governance. This reluctance to acknowledge defeat and hand over power in a civilized way. It started in the United States, but we saw this in Brazil and in some other places. So unfortunately, Poland is the latest case of that. There was some speculation last week that Law and Justice and President Andrzej Duda, who is allied with the party, could try to actually prolong this deadlock and by refusing to accept the oath of office from Donald Tusk, who is the candidate of the new majority in parliament for prime minister, on some spurious grounds that he was too soft on Russia, which is an accusation levied on him by Law and Justice during the campaign, but also by this special committee the party set up in parliament or just outside parliament but by parliament to investigate quote-unquote Russian influence. And just last week they came out with again, quote-unquote, recommendation that Tusk should not be entrusted with any public positions, which of course is, you know, this declaration is totally illegal. It's groundless, and the president was to his credit, the president very quickly came out with a denial that he would use this as a pretext to delay the appointment of the opposition government.
I want to pick this a little bit apart just because I think some people, you know, there's been a great delay, of course, in the transition of power. And I think most of our listeners are aware of that. But in the instance where, let's say, Duda would not allow Tusk to become, would not just appoint him as the prime minister. What situation would we find Poland in?
Well, it would be a turmoil. It would be certainly a constitutional crisis, because you would have a cabinet elected by parliament with a parliamentary mandate to govern. And the constitution is explicit about this, saying, you know, the president shall appoint a cabinet elected by parliament. So it leaves very little room for the president to exercise any kind of discretion there. But should the president simply refuse to take an oath of office, that's uncharted territory. There have been suggestions that in such a case, you know, the ministers in the new cabinet would just go to their ministries with the resolution of parliament electing them and use that as a legal basis to take over power. But, you know, just for the sake of argument, if the outgoing government ministers refuse to leave the building, you know, you would end up with a total mess. And I think, you know, I think at the end of the day, I'm glad that we're just, you know, we're speculating on a scenario that is not going to materialize.
Well, we hope so, yes.
and that sense prevailed in this case. But in many ways, it just signifies how far has the outgoing government and the ruling party played fast and loose with all sorts of rules and customs, because you know, just think for a moment about the fact that, you know, it's almost two months since the elections, and from day one it was clear that the opposition parties had a majority in parliament, that they were willing to form a coalition together, and they even signed a sort of formal coalition agreement. And still President Duda broke with the previous custom that the leader of the majority would be entrusted with forming the next government. Instead, he waited a very long time to call the first sitting of parliament. Then he said he would appoint, and he appointed Mr. Morawiecki, the outgoing prime minister, even though he had no majority. Mr. Morawiecki is taking his time to win the vote of confidence, so he's really stretching that schedule to the maximum, just to delay the transition of power. So, you know, I'm not surprised that there was this speculation that maybe they're prepared to use every possible trick to prevent the handover.
It is interesting. Also, with the, I mean, but it does seem that, as you kind of, you know, rightly kind of noted in your article, that this won't occur, and we should mention that, of course, or we don't believe it will, and that there will be a new government next week in Poland. And this is just in time for the summit, the Ukrainian summit for the EU. But I'm wondering, what else is at stake? Because we know that there's a lot of funding that has been kind of delayed coming to Poland, and that I hope you can expand on this briefly, but the timeline for that, because I believe the funds have to be at least transferred partially by the end of the year. Is that correct? Those that have been withheld for the rule of law violations?
That's a bit vague. I think we're a little bit in the fog there, because we don't know how this is going to play out. I think on a sort of political level, I think there's obvious understanding that the new government in Poland will restore the rule of law in the country and will stop harassing judges, will ensure judicial independence. From a legal point of view, certain things need to happen to restore formal independence of the judiciary after the some of the changes by the previous administration were questioned by EU courts and clearly abuse the independence of the judiciary. But the big question is, to what extent the EU and the European Commission in particular will be able to sort of trust that the Polish government is eventually going to correct all these measures and therefore will unblock the funds. So in other words, you know, will they sort of extend the money on credit based on declarations, on political declarations of the new government that they will change things? The reason why I'm stressing this is because even if the coalition, as it said, would pass the legislation as to meet EU requirements, it is not obvious that President Duda is going to sign them into law. He may veto these new regulations, in which case, from a formal point of view, the path may be closed because the opposition isn't strong enough in parliament to muster a three-fifths majority to repel the veto.
Correct.
In which case, restoring rule of law in Poland has to be done through administrative measures that the government can take without President Duda's consent. So this, we need to see how it plays out. But I think on a political level, both the Commission and the EU Council and the Polish government will be determined to find ways of unlocking the money for Poland.
Well, that's great. It's a ray of hope after a couple of years. We'll have to, of course, see how it develops. But
yeah, it's very important because Poland, in some sense, this government, this new incoming administration is lucky a little bit,
yeah.
I have to say, because, the economy is beginning to pick up after a slump. Inflation is coming down like everywhere else. So if the zloty is strengthening on investor confidence, so if this EU money comes in now, we can see a huge sort of impact on investment next year and in the following year, which of course then is going to translate into higher growth and more prosperity. So, I think this is a priority for the new administration to unlock EU funds.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much, Adam. I really appreciate you discussing your text. It's an important article, and I think events will be developing in just the coming days. And, we can all, I hope our listeners can stay tuned to hear. Of course, we will keep them well informed about any changes that might occur. But please stay tuned for the second part of the podcast, where Editor-in-Chief Wojciech Przybylski will discuss with Caroline Horstein-Tomich the state of European civic education. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you.
I'm inviting you now to listen to a conversation with one of the leading figures in the movements of pan-European civic education. Caroline Horstein-Tomich comes from Croatian-based The Civics organization that, together with its offices in Sofia, Bulgaria, and Bonn, Germany, organize the pan-European network of European civic education in Europe. And this is one of the themes that we also highlight in our report on the future priorities of the European Union, the so-called EU strategic agenda that is going to be decided and finalized by the time the new commission is settled in mid-2024. In this report and the foresight discussions that accompanied that report, we emphasize the need and the necessity of focusing on the civics in Europe, in civic education, and also the ability for building up cohesion, specifically for democracy development, but also because the shape of our societies determine the ability of our democracies to stand ground against revisionist powers that are building up across the world, specifically pronounced by the recent invasion of Russia on Ukraine, but also a much bigger challenge, a systemic challenge of revisionist powers like China or Russia to the set of principles and values that have been shaping a democratic multilateral world order so far. My name is Wojciech Przybylski. I'm editor-in-chief of Visegrad Insight. Let's listen to Caroline Horstein-Tomich. Caroline, thanks for speaking for Visegrad Insight podcast. And I wanted to ask you particularly, why are we meeting in Madrid? Why the network of European civic education meeting is taking place in Madrid, and the civics which you had, from which you are directing together with colleagues, is organizing it as and what is the ambition of the gathering?
Well, let me start with our choice of Madrid. It was an obvious choice with Spain holding the EU Council presidency. So we thought that corresponds very much with what our work is about and what NECE, the Network of European Civic Education, is trying to focus on. We try to focus on the transfer of experience and knowledge and the networking between people who are civic educators all over Europe. And there is a lot out there. And NECE is a platform that provides possibilities for exchange, for meetings, for knowledge transfer and capacity building. And this is, first of all, why we meet once a year to a festival. Formerly, it was a conference. Now we open this to also a new group of actors, which means more diverse and younger actors in civic education. And Madrid is a place that couldn't be better because it also reaches out to colleagues in the MENA region. And we go annually for the festival to different places. One year, rather in the southern part of Europe, in other times, next year we will go to Tirana. So every year you'll find us in a different corner of Europe.
How important the civic education topic becomes these days? I mean, and who stands behind it? Maybe we can start with the civics. Why the civics and civic education?
Well, let me explain a little bit from our starting, which was actually during the pandemics, that we found it is crucial to provide spaces for people who are engaged in civic education to meet each other. Because sometimes it's very lonely out there when you are in a local community and you try to do civic work in a local community. You feel like you are at the forefront of solving the social problems and the cultural problems that we have in our local communities today. And the civics is actually founded out of this necessity to bring visibility to what civic educators are doing in small and remote areas as much as in urban centers, where a lot of course is happening in the formal sector. The civics also is concerned about the interconnection between the formal civic educators, the teachers in schools, and the informal sector, and also those that engage in the non-formal way for civic education, which is often happening ad hoc. It's happening as a reaction to a local pressing issue. For example, in the field of climate education, we have a local conflict that needs addressing, and so local groups develop or informal networks, informal initiatives emerge to address those issues.
And last time before we met in Madrid today, we met at Forum, at the European Forum Albach, and we organized the Civic Lab, bringing in key stakeholders from civic education from all across Europe to conduct a strategic foresight exercise on civic education. What would you say are the examples of the most impressive or inspiring civic education programming that exists in Europe? Where to seek for examples? Apart from the grassroots, which are, as you said, responding to the immediate needs, where to look for some new structures, even leadership in terms of advancing civic education, apart from the civics, from the organization that you're leading from outside, from Croatia, but with network potential with many other countries?
Yes, we have with the civics three hubs. One in Bulgaria and Sofia, one in Bonn, Germany, and one in Zagreb. But we have lots of local partners all over Europe. This was crucial for the mapping of civic education that we conducted in the past 2 years. The first round mapped 21 countries and was surveying organizations and also individuals who are vested in civic education. We are now doing the second round of the mapping, which covers another 10 countries. So through the mapping, we see a lot of very innovative and interesting work that's been done. I would like to go back to your first or previous question, which I didn't completely answer, because I would like to stress civic educators are no firefighters. We cannot solve the problems that are out there, but we are a crucial intermediary for addressing issues. We need platforms, we need spaces today to actually come together, to organize dialogue, to bring people together that don't interact anymore at all, to address the conflicts that we have in society, and to find ways and common ground, not for consensus, but for compromise. But in order to compromise, you need to acknowledge that you have different stances. And the more diverse a society is, the more heterogeneous stances and perspectives on problems do we have. So we are responsible and vested in multi-perspectivity. We are vested and committed to controversy. Controversy needs to be brought before and not being put under the carpet. And that is what is missing in many of our societies today. Let me, for example, point out initiatives that we see in Finland. Finland is a very strong actor in adult education. It's really outstanding what they're doing. And in many of the other European countries, adult education is done, but maybe not in the most innovative way. And we feel that it is crucial to break the silos, and Finland has a good approach here, the silos of different generations. We need to bring people together cross-generationally. We need to address topics that are of concern of any age group in at any stage in the life cycle. We are aging societies in Europe, so adults are a very crucial voters group up until old age. We need to have them look into a future they don't have anymore, but other generations are going to co-opt and to inherit. And this is something that is very important to create more knowledge and see what's done in other places in Europe and help people develop their own programs in environments where there is no offer yet.
It seems like these cases and the whole knowledge base that you're developing along with the key leaders in the sector are really indeed a lesson for European Union as well, that does not tackle civic education or European civic education itself. But well, if it is to continue and develop, probably it has to innovate in this area.
I couldn't agree more. And this is what we try to, from the bottom up, make visible with NICE, to also to Brussels and those in charge for education, to see that we jointly need to develop an idea of what civic education, of the crucial place of civic education in the educational panopticum that we have in Europe, that embraces, of course, the formal sector, but also the informal sector, which should be seen as an ally. A lot of work is done in cooperation. In some countries, you do not find a cooperation between the formal and non-formal or informal sector. In others, it's already institutionalized. So climate education in Germany, for example, very much draws on the knowledge and on the work that is done in the informal sector that provides skills and competences through capacity building, but also learning material. Teacher education today is crucial because teachers work on the forefront of the societal problems. In the classroom, you find the biggest, the microcosm of our heterogeneous society. Diversification, conflict shows in classroom. So teachers need to know how to address it and how to moderate discussion, how to bring voices to the fore that are marginalized. This is something that informal civic education has been looking into a long time. It's not enough recognized what knowledge there is and experience, but if you can bring this into the formal sector, you build a very strong alliance that is, I feel, future-proofing education in Europe for the challenges that we are facing.
Thank you very much.